This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Decades ago, a large portion of American society would often rely on the same entities when it came to consuming news. Whether it was a physical morning newspaper or their most trusted man in America, Walter Cronkite, reporting on the evening news, there was a general public trust in these entities to provide true and unbiased news coverage. Today, with hundreds of outlets offering the latest and breaking news, our media consumption is now far more decentralized. Now there's clickbait from non-news sites masquerading as news. There are advertisements that are hard to distinguish from news articles. There are entities intentionally trying to trick consumers with false information. And there's a lot of media that pretends to be journalism when it isn't. Whether that distrust comes from fictitious news stories shared on Facebook, from influence campaigns, or from the president's labeling of the press as the enemy of the people, the question that remains is, why should the public have trust in the press? On today's forum, an expert panel aims to answer just that. Speaking on the panel are S.J. Quinney College of Law professor Rennell Anderson-Jones, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and Deseret News editor Doug Wilkes. And moderating today's discussion is Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Today's forum was recorded on November 12th, 2018. Here's Jason Perry.
Okay, but here's where we're going to start. We did a poll not too long ago. This one we did in association with the Salt Lake Tribune, where we asked participants a series of questions, including what their trust was in public entities and whether or not they thought these entities acted in the best interests of the public. We included the media in that particular poll, and in this poll, 11% of Utahns said they had a great deal of trust in the media. 43% said they had some, 42% said none. That's just a very interesting poll. So we're going to start here. Doug, can we start with you, work our way here? I just want you to make a case, all right? Why are we just not answering that question right? Why should we have trust in the press?
You know, I think the part of the issue there is when you ask a question of, do you trust the media, how would each of you answer it, right? Because you're thinking of media in a certain way. You're thinking of cable news, or you're thinking of local press, the Tribune, the Deseret News, local radio. You could be thinking of Access Hollywood, entertainment programming, the entertainment industry. And often we'll get a reaction, or I'll get a reaction as I talk about the media with people who call either to support us or complain about us. They have a very particular view of the media. My case for the media is that I think locally we are trying to do a good job of looking at government, trying to keep the courts open. We work together to keep the courts open. We spend a lot of money to try and keep the courts open. So if you're following and reading us, I think you can make a strong case that for what we're trying to do in Utah and for the nation, that you can trust your local media, your local press. If you want to start talking nationally, I mean, we have a lot to say about national and that, you know, but you really have to say, well, I trust some media, but perhaps not all media. That's how I would answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jennifer? Yeah, we're going to have
So I wish that we had decided as a Hinckley Tribune poll team to split it up and to ask specific questions about local media, national media, and social media, because I do think people tend to put everything in one little place, and in their minds, they're evaluating them separately. I do think that I saw some poll numbers from a Gallup national poll that showed that a majority, so over 50% of Americans, do not trust the media at all. I mean, that is just dismal. There's got to be a way for us to tell our story. I think part of that comes through telling how we do our job. I don't think traditionally journalists have explained the hoops that they have to jump through before something is published, for example. So we need to do a better job of telling you, the public, how we do what we do. But we also need to talk more about stories that matter and resonate with the audience. So lots to talk about.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that point in just a minute, too, because that's probably the next thing I want to talk about is how you decide. But Rennell,
So I think I agree with them that the sweeping term, the media, is part of the problem here, because it's easy, particularly in an era of othering, right? We've seen this as a trend in all of politics and all of national conversation, that there is this construction of a lot of institutions as the enemy, right? As this other that is not to be trusted. And I think that's partially a deliberate attempt by the current administration and by loads of people in politics to tap into what political scientists are pretty consistently telling us is a really effective mechanism to define themselves at, in contrast to an enemy. And so the media, sort of in a sweeping term, starts to get labeled in that way. And so people's instinct is to say, no, that's an entity I don't trust. I've been taught not to trust that. But if you actually ask them, you know, where do you get your information? How do you find out about what's going on in the world around you? How do you find out what's going on in your community? How do you find out what's happening with the administration or with Congress? Almost everyone has a couple of sources that they turn to, and sometimes those sources are polarized sources, right? And so what they're saying is, you know, I don't trust the media. I mean, I trust MSNBC, but not the media, right? Or I trust Fox News, but not the media. And so if they had the chance to be questioned more specifically, mm-hmm. they might say there are some entities in that they rely on quite heavily for information that they do trust. So a piece of the question is what we can do to help people understand the wider array of choices on the media landscape and also to give them a chance to sort of break out of their silos and spend some time comparing and contrasting media sources in ways that might be helpful.
Okay. Let's hit a little piece on that you mentioned. Because if we did ask people, do you have any sources you trust, they probably have their... They have their favorite...
Their Facebook friends.
Their favorite... Yeah, the Facebook friends is right. Jennifer, how do you kind of address that? This kind of this narrow casting idea where people tend to maybe look at broader media as something they don't trust, but I'm only really going to focus on this one narrow, probably of like-minded people that seem to be selling the stuff I want to buy.
That's a pretty recent innovation, right? I mean, we used to have three networks, and we all got our news from the same sources. There's always been a lot of newspapers, but on the broadcast side, it was very condensed, and I think that people tended to trust when you have fewer news sources. Now we've got literally millions and millions of sources for you to look at. And so you can pick and choose who you like, and you can exclude those sources of news that you don't like. I think trust is a little bit different issue versus preference. But, you know, when you are self-selecting just a narrow band of points of view, it can become... isolating. It becomes a little bit dangerous in some ways not to have the full spectrum of opinions and thought out there. So, yeah, we all select how much time do you have to spend on news, right? I can only consume 4 or 5 newspapers a day. But I also look at other broadcasts and other social media as well, trying to figure out where the truth lies. So I think it's really, really, the onus has become you know, the consumers have to choose what they trust. And if you don't trust anything, we're all in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Doug, let's talk about that for just a moment, because I want to hear how you go about deciding what you put in the paper. But maybe I start with that interesting point is that a factor that you consider, any of you, whether in the news business, whether or not people are trusting what you put out, is that a filter you add, or is you just put out what you feel like you should put out?
Well, back in the old days, you put out what you thought you should put out, right? Journalists were the gatekeepers. Journalists could become very arrogant. We could say we know better because we're engaged in monitoring this or watchdogging government. But now there's a lot of people out there putting out information and news. What do I do personally? We listen to our readers and to our users online. We have people who tell us that various news sources are biased. I don't just cast that aside. I look at the specific story. I look at how it's written. We're in an interesting time because of our president, because it used to be that you'd have conservative columnists and liberal columnists or points of view. Well, now you have many conservative columnists who are also attacking the president for the way he comports himself, and liberal columnists who do the same thing. So now you have people out there who want to support the president who can't find a voice that represents them, so they think all of media is biased. So we could try to go at principle and try to say, well, what is actually happening? What is the president's doing? So we try to do a little bit of cutting through the noise that we know is out there to provide points of view from a factual, honest, truthful place. But unless you're reading every day and actually engaged as a reader, you may read a story that you find on your Facebook post and then a week later read something that you don't like. And unless you're really engaged every day with the media source, you don't know how hard media is working to try and get it right.
So, Ronell, as you're talking with people and you're looking at the press generally, let's talk about this idea, what both Doug and Jennifer were saying, whether there's a preference issue or a trust issue. All right, so how have you seen that breakdown in the people with what they subscribe to and what they believe?
I think it's a little of each. I think that they overlap in sort of concentric circles. And there's actually a lot of really interesting social science brain science, cognitive behavioral science data that is now emerging that lots of people in the law and communications areas are starting to think about our capacity as humans to sort of seek out information that is a disconnect with what our priors are. And it turns out that we're very lazy, right? We're just sort of fundamentally lazy thinkers. And so we like it when people reinforce things that we thought before, and we dislike it when people say things that conflict with what we thought before. And I think at the outset of the sort of beginning of the internet, and certainly as social media sort of started to take hold, lots of legal and communication scholars really thought that this was going to be a moment for the expansion of truth and the marketplace of ideas, that there would be all of these amazing ways for us to check our priors and for us to compare and contrast different viewpoints and for us to think about things from lots of different vantage points. And right, you know, all the flowers would bloom and the marketplace would have all of these participants and truth would emerge. And what I think a lot of people didn't anticipate was that our brain chemistries would take over in ways that would be a little more complicated than that. And that despite the fact that you have 200 television channels to choose from and all manner of sources on Twitter and Facebook and all blogs and various online news sources and legacy media sources, that what we still do is seek out the comfortable, right? We look for what makes us feel comfortable. And we seek sources that don't challenge us, but rather reinforce us. And that has been particularly true in the last couple of years as the political world has mapped onto the media world in those sorts of ways, where we have a very divisive political community. And if we are divisive politically, we seek out media sources that sort of help us gravitate in those ways. A couple of years ago, just after the election, actually, I made a concerted effort to give myself a red Facebook feed and a blue Facebook feed. That is to draw upon friends from various circles in my life who were very conservative and who were very liberal, and to be able to sort of watch the ways that those two communities were talking to each other. And I did this in part because I read a piece in the Wall Street Journal about Facebook and the way that it has sort of gravitated to be these silos of people just talking to each other rather than thinking about views that are not their own. And it is one of the most interesting things happening in my life right now.
Do they interact?
Never is there any intersection between the two, right? So in the lead up to the midterms, I'm watching my red feed having these conversations about the things that frighten them and the things that concern them and the things that they're worried about and various stories, right? The spin that the story has in the red side is entirely not even in the same, it's not even on the same planet yeah. as what's happening in my blue feed. And I think that's the reason that the election was so surprising to people on both sides of the aisle. It's the reason that conversations are really hard to have across the political aisle. It's the reason why we have trouble coming up with actual legitimate bipartisan solutions, because we deliberately burrow ourselves into a
a comfort zone, and because technology has put us in a place where we can do that in terms of our media consumption.
Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't solve Thanksgiving, right?
No, it certainly okay. doesn't. Right, unless you only invite your blue feed to That's Thanksgiving. Right.
So let's talk, Jennifer and Doug. So let's talk about, as the editors, you're deciding what stories to run, what to pursue. Let's just take this as kind of a foundation, what Ronell was just describing. If there is, people are preferring their red feeds or their blue feeds, how do you find a balance? Are you looking for a balance between those two as you're making really big decisions about what we Utahns and around the world are going to read? How do you decide that?
We're looking at it not that we have to give a certain number of red stories or blue stories to the public. We don't think that way. We don't think in terms of good news versus bad news. We think in terms of news. So, for example, sometimes if we're looking at a Wire report, an Associated Press will have a certain number of stories, and I'll read how they're approaching the story. And I can see bias in some of those reports. I see our own coverage, whether we're covering the governor or healthcare or the marijuana debate, right? The marijuana debate is something where you have to work very, very hard to try and get factual, honest information when you have an issue that's really hitting people in a lot of different ways. So the way we do it, I do it, is you go story by story, issue by issue, and you try to have an honest, truthful point of view.
I would totally agree with that. I'm not thinking, will this appeal to my liberal base? Will this appeal to the Republicans out there who are conservative? Will this appeal to the young audience? Actually, I do think about that a lot. If a story is going to attract a younger audience to the Tribune. I guess one thing that we do a lot of is thinking about proving ourselves. So again, I don't think journalists are very good at talking about the interview process, the reporting process, the editing process. It really is a daily fact check kind of thing, and readers don't see any of that. So we're trying to give more of a window through links and through a whole range of sources to let people know how we got here, how we got to the finished story. I'm hoping that will help, but yeah, I'm not. I guess the only reason I would think about my red feed and my blue feed is on social media. Most of you do not come to sltrib.com to get your news. Most of you are getting it through either a social feed or through SEO, through a search, Google Engine search. So I'm thinking about how do I get my story in front of the audience where they are, rather than the feed coming to me, if that makes sense.
Now, I might also add to that. So we do spend a lot of time on headlines and trying to say whether it's for search or some other way, but you have a whole story to deal with the nuance. A headline, you're trying to get someone to the story, and you have to be very clever and very smart and take time to get the headline that's gonna both attract a reader, but also be fair and compelling and not one-sided. So we spend a lot of time, and we're still doing that, trying to get the headline right.
That's Doug Wilkes, editor for the Deseret News. And you are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are featuring a discussion on the level of trust the public has in the media. Here again is the forum moderator, Jason Perry.
Do you mind taking just a moment on kind of the process itself, all right? Not many of us have a chance to say, well, what happens? Who's meeting together in the morning on a paper saying, this is what we care about covering today, or this is what's going to be on the front page, or put somewhere else? Can you give us a little view of that?
Yeah, so on Monday mornings, the entire newsroom is invited to what we call the story jam.
you've heard stuff at the bar over the weekend or at church or whatever. What are people talking about? What stories should we be chasing? Are there particular angles that we should be? And, you know, we generate a whole list of story ideas and then we start to divvy them up. So that's on a Monday. The rest of the week, the editors meet twice a day and we start looking at priorities and what's happened and what we expect to happen. And then we put together our cast of characters and the reporters go forth. So after the 10 o'clock meeting, my reporters are on the phone and, you know, out interviewing, attending things, whatever. And they'll be continually reporting back to their editors of what they've found. At the 3:30 meeting, the editors make priorities for both print and how it's going to play on the web. There's just a constant churn of stories. There's more stories than we can get to. So what are the stories that have the most impact? What are the ones that will reach a diverse audience? What are the ones that are the most important for any Utahn to know at any given time? With finite resources, you have to make some tough choices. But my reporters are constantly on the phone, on social media, out in the community. They're taking videos. They're attending events. So it's all over the place. It's sort of this orchestrated chaos every day.
Doug?
Yeah, we have a couple different ways we do this. We have a multi-platform newsroom, which means our newsroom, we have reporters with KSL TV, KSL Radio, KSL.com, DeseretNews.com. And we also have an in-depth team. And at various times, those teams are meeting together. The editors are in constant conversation. The digital teams are meeting, talking about the priorities for both DeseretNews.com and KSL.com. We've gone to a lot more in-depth coverage, so we deal with that on short-term or things we want to comment on right now and long-term projects. The one thing I will say is the editors are in constant conversation and you're doing things digitally in real time and you're doing things still for a print product where you have a progression through the day and that changes, right? And even when you go home at night, it can change at 10 at night. So you still have these kind of two ways of doing things. One is the real time digital and long-term planning and the other time is this sort of print product. But it starts early. You know, a traditional news meeting would be at 9 or 10 o'clock. We have people in much earlier doing work on that. And on the TV side, you know, they're on the air at 4:30. So on the one hand, it's the Deseret News, but because we do have different platforms under the same roof, we're able to kind of help and use each other.
Okay. Ronell, before we take some questions from the audience, I just want to ask you about something you sort of alluded to. There's been a little bit of tension with some elements of government. The president of the United States in particular in the press just this last week. Can you comment on what's happening with that relationship, proper kind of exchange between the two? And when one just, maybe if you don't like what's happening, you just yank a press credential.
Yeah, this has been a source of a lot of my recent scholarship and a lot of commentary by academics who think about politics and the press and the law and the press. I think we're at a really precarious time in press-president relations, and a lot of my recent research has actually demonstrated that. So press-president tension is not new. That is not a new thing. That is an old thing, and it's a thing that has existed. If you study even just the modern presidency, there are loads of examples of presidents who disliked the press and the press pushing back on presidents. What does seem new? What is different, not just in degree, but in kind, is that other modern presidents felt a need for a wide variety of reasons, including the fact that we used to live in a media world in which everyone was very reliant on the media, right? If you had three or four TV networks and a handful of newspapers that were the main source of information about the president had to stay in the good graces of them, right? And with Twitter and with other mechanisms, the president has discovered that they are no longer sort of a necessary evil. They're just an evil, right? And he can sort of characterize them in that way. And what it means is that we now see, in contrast to previous presidents, who would complain a lot about the press and who would push back, have a lot of tension with the press. The other presidents at least had an undercurrent of respect for the democratic institution. They would say, I hate what they're doing. I want to clarify something that they've written. I will characterize them as sloppy or as inappropriate or as having not gotten the full story. But, and even, right, even Nixon, who is definitely the second runner-up on this front, if you're sort of investigating historically, if you read in a recent piece that a co-author and I did, we sort of dug really deep and investigated the kinds of things that the parallels between Trump and Nixon and the ways that they part ways. And where we see them paralleling is that they would say things like, you know, the press is the enemy, we hate them, we're at war with them. Nixon is saying this privately. Privately to his internal aides, he's declaring war on the press. And publicly, he is saying, I hate what they're writing, but the press is an important democratic institution, right? I will defend freedom of the press. It is important to me not to sweep with sort of a broad brushstroke and declare them the enemy overtly to all of you. Trump is doing the exact opposite, right? A very clear campaign to engage in this othering of the press and to do things that have been seen as outside the scope of propriety in the past, like removing press credentials from members of the press pool. And it has been a mounting campaign. We've seen it started at the very beginning of the Trump candidacy, and it heightened, as a lot of things in the Trump candidacy did, when the feedback was positive for it, right? So when the base says, this is something that we can get riled up about, this is something that gets applause at campaign rallies, it becomes a sort of more and more heightened situation. It concerns me. I'm concerned more about this enemy construction of the press than I am about other enemy construction that is happening in the Trump administration. There's a great deal of this othering, right, of the us and them, the people that we can trust and the people that we can't trust, the people who are in and the people who are out. But a lot of these other efforts to construct groups as enemies, right, immigrants across the southern border, Muslims or other religions, political foes, certain the intelligence community, right? When we're doing all of that othering, the buffer that we've traditionally had to that kind of othering has been the press, right? The press pushes back and says, actually, here are the ways that those narratives need to be clarified, or here are some facts that we can bring to the table, or here are ways that we can help get a fuller story out. So if the administration is successful in constructing the press as an enemy, it opens the door to these other forms of enemy construction of other really important democratic institutions in ways that concern me a lot.
Questions from the audience. Do we have anyone that's ready right now?
Okay. So my question is, in this environment, what do you think of, this is like a fantasy idea, of a media outlet that was backed and created by high-profile, respected, moderate people from both the liberal and conservative sides for the very purpose of supporting unity and addressing this conflict? Like, does that kind of a thing have any kind of...
Yeah, like the a resurrection of Uncle Walt, right? This is the Walter Cronkite model of who works for us rather than for a viewpoint, or who is at least perceived to do so. I actually think it's that there may well be a space, right, a demand for this sort of more neutral filter, right? A filter that comes together that is describing themselves as exercising editorial discretion on a top value of unifying bipartisan information flow, right? I think that's a really interesting idea. I think a companion idea to that might be, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about and something that people I think are now starting to talk about, is this sort of notion of sort of media literacy education, right, as a component of civic education. And both of those things, I think, are woefully missing in our country. Civic education used to be something that we prioritized a lot more than we do now. And media literacy and sort of media consumption skills as a tool of media literacy and civic education seems really important. Being able to talk to people in middle school and in high school about information sources, to say, here are information sources that are engaged in the kind of background checking that you'd like to see. Here are the ways that you can know, here are the signals you can see in the story when they tell you, we talked to X, Y, and Z, or we reached out to so-and-so for comment, or the way that you can parse through a piece of information and know that it was approached fairly, or that it has extra information, or even if you don't have your dream, nonpartisan entity, how to fill your feed with lots of different entities so that you can compare and contrast and be a responsible citizen who exposes herself to lots of different opportunities. And I think thinking creatively about those sorts of mechanisms might be a part of the path forward.
Doug,
I might just say, I think, yeah, rather than create some sort of dream source, that it really does come down to media literacy for the public. You know, the First Amendment, you know, freedom of the press, freedom to gather, freedom of speech, that doesn't belong to the president and it doesn't belong to the press. It belongs to each of us as people. And if you can kind of take that and say, oh, I have ownership of that, now what's my responsibility, right? We talk a lot about people not taking the opportunity to vote. Well, take the opportunity to vote, get media literate, and find the sources that you think add to your life. And then you can put the pressure back on the media to try and do something well. I mean, Walter Cronkite didn't belong to the people. He was helping make money for CBS News. But his task was to be a newsreader, and he read it very specifically. And then only occasionally would he kind of, I mean, he was a managing editor too, so you know the choices he made were very important. But it was a very different time and a very different expectation. Well, if you in the audience have an expectation of something and you're engaged in it, then you can put pressure back on the media to get the information that you want or need.
And I guess I would push back just a little bit on your assumption that there's this ideal out there, there's this moderate voice. I would say that most reporters want to be that. They are trying to be that. It's the overlay of editorial boards and ownership and opinion voices that are often louder than the reporter's voice. So I would say that, at least in my newsroom, my reporters, obviously, they have biases, personal biases, but they don't want that to be reflected in their work product. And if anything, they try to bend over backwards to present an array of viewpoints.
Yeah, and let me just say that about, because I agree with Jennifer on that. If you look at election night, what were the sets of CNN and Fox and MSNBC and ABC? You had 9 chairs of people talking about something. Well, you have the numbers and the facts and you have what's happening. But then most of the night is 9 people. Now, do you know which ones of those people were reporters? Which ones of them belong to a Democratic Party or Republican Party? So where there is this kind of an approach, you have to have transparency, because each of us do have a bias of some sort, whether we try to hide it or not. But if you know where I'm coming from and you know where Jennifer's coming from, that at least gives you a fighting chance, right? So I think transparency is a place where media really has to move forward, and we're trying to, I think.
Very good. Okay, another question from the audience.
Okay, my question is, I guess it's concerning mostly free speech, but how do we reconcile, I guess, what would be considered hate speech on the national news level? So, for example, Don Lemon said that, I got the quote right here. He said, the biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized to the right. So, again, we have free speech, but how do we reconcile that? Because if that was going any other way, you know, that's pretty not in line with university policies, I would say.
This goes back to media literacy. So Don Lemon is not a reporter. Don Lemon is not a journalist. He doesn't subscribe to the ethics. He's an opinionator. He's a commentator. He's offering one point of view. He's under this umbrella of a network that is a news network, but the majority of their employees are opinion writers. They're not journalists. that's where it gets tricky, I think, for reporters who are out there trying to find truth and to maintain trust of an audience when you have all these multiplicity of voices coming from all, and we're all lumped in to the same bucket. It's not really fair.
The other thing is, you know, you've defined what he said as hate speech, but, you know, the person next to you might not, might just say, well, that's opinion, and it's a valid opinion I want to hear about. So there's not a real common ground in the country right now for some of these things, and that's one thing we're struggling with, right? You know, what is decent? You know, can we have a civic conversation? The need for enemies. Having an enemy is a very good strategy if you want to win something. You know, a football team, well, here's my opponent, here's the enemy. You have a big rally about how you're going to defeat the enemy, and then you go out and you defeat the enemy. Okay, well, the problem is in a society that doesn't really benefit us because you want to have the good at the forefront. One last thing I'll say about that. Jeff Flake said something very telling on 60 Minutes. So he was heralded for having some principle, and when they went through the confirmation hearings for a new Supreme Court justice, he was asked, you know, and he said, no, we need to take a pause. We need to have an investigation for at least a week. And he was able to influence power to that end. 60 Minutes reporter asked him, well, if you were running for re-election, could you have done that? And he said immediately, absolutely not. So does that mean he's totally compromised or any elected officials compromised? It was the most telling moment for me because I thought, boy, that's just a horrible thing that if you're working on principle, but you're saying absolutely you would not be able to do that, then the country's in kind of a precarious place.
Yeah, your comment also taps into something that I, as a free speech and free press scholar, am hearing a lot about and that I think people are starting to talk about a lot more in ways that I think are healthy. There is a massive divide between what we are free to say in this country under First Amendment standards and the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court, and what we might think is appropriate for us to say in dialogue that is civil on matters of public concern. I'm just going to take this moment, just because I have the microphone, to make a shout out for, we're having the annual Fordham debate at the law school this Thursday on the question of campus speech and First Amendment values on university campuses. And it's a microcosm of a wider issue that you tapped into, right? Which is this notion of what sorts of things we think are appropriate and decent and civilized and kind and demonstrate unity and demonstrate good leadership from our leaders as compared to what sorts of things we are free to say. And the divide between this is pretty great. What you described there would not under any circumstances be characterized by any court in this country as hate speech, because the hate speech doctrine from the United States Supreme Court is incredibly generous to speech, right? You can say a lot of things that are quite racist and quite inappropriate and quite insulting and hurtful and personally vile, and they are protected under First Amendment doctrine because the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment in incredibly generous ways on the understanding, as Doug says, right, that there are a multiplicity of views that people, that the thinking is that the best remedy for speech that we find ugly and inappropriate and vile is more speech that is appropriate and that says we won't stand for that and that we aren't racist and that we are good people and that we have good values. And so part of the conversation that we need to be having in this country isn't about the scope of freedom of speech, but rather is about the scope of what we want to be the baseline for our conversations about matters of public concern. Can we be civil? Can we demand that our leaders speak in ways that unify us and that are decent to the whole population and that are sensitive to minority communities? There's two trains of commentary that are happening here. We need to know about our First Amendment rights, and we also need to be committed to dialogue that is civilized.
I would just add one last thing. What is hate speech here is not hate speech in Europe. They have very strict laws. So Don Lemon probably could not say that on broadcast in Europe. Whereas here, we want more speech. We celebrate it. You may disagree with it, but freedom of the press is and freedom of speech is enshrined in our Constitution, you know, so You may find something offensive. You may not want Ben Shapiro on this campus, whatever. But that's where a free society gains its strength, is in having a dialogue and having diverse points of view expressed.
You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. In this final segment, the panel takes further questions from the audience of students and faculty.
Well, I'm particularly alarmed about the trend of decreased subscriptions with the printed word. I think that's the only way that we can get a balanced story. I'm not denigrating the broadcast news, but they have such a short period of time to cover each subject of the news. And so I don't watch television news anymore. Where I get my information is from the printed word. The Trib, the Deseret News, I can compare those two. But I see among the younger trend, and that's not so young, that they're not the printed word, in my opinion, is the way you get the balance, because you have time to cover the subject. I'd like your response on that.
Doug?
Well, I wouldn't think of it in terms of print anymore. I mean, we're trying to do that, but in a digital space. And we each have a certain number of print readers, but overwhelmingly we have far more digital readers, and it gives you far greater reach. So, younger people, students who aren't, watching, television news, they're also not reading a printed newspaper. They're getting it from sources that they've created. You have Apple News, you have all these competitors into this space. But we're committed to doing in-depth content. We're committed to doing stories that are also quick hits. Axios has a model where they're doing just these sort of facts and what it means to you and trying just to crystallize that. But by the same token, they'll have links that'll get you to more in-depth content. We're also trying to do that where we'll give you an in-depth piece, even some that are 5,000 words or 6,000 words, which is very, very long. But then you've got to have another way into it. When the New York Times just did its 14,000-word piece on President Trump's finances, they also did a 2,500-word piece to try and crystallize it because they knew the other media would do that. So rather than let the other media do that, they also offered that up. So these are solutions to try and get at what you're talking about, not to lose it. Because print will go away. It doesn't make any sense to print it. Everything is now, and the key is to get the reach digitally and make you comfortable enough reading the story, probably on your phone, because overwhelmingly you're getting it on your phone more than going to a desktop.
I spent most of my career in broadcast, so it was like a race against time, a race against the clock. In print, it's, I think, evolving into that same, oh my gosh, I've got 15 seconds to get somebody hooked into my story. How can I do that the most efficiently, the most colorfully, and still give depth? That is one thing that newspapers do so well, is provide depth, but you do still have to deliver it in a way. If you don't want to read 15,000 words on something, how can you still get the nugget of truth that we're presenting to you that's important for every citizen to know in a condensed way, because we're racing against time and we know that you have so many other options. Where do you want to spend that time?
Everything. Before we really
I just want to add one thing, which is that The concern that I have maps onto your concern, which is that we have increasingly moved to a culture, and particularly amongst younger people, who do not think of news as something that is worth paying for. And I have a real concern about that, that journalism doesn't produce itself. Good reportage doesn't produce itself. And a lot of the sources that people turn to for information now are really in the business of repeatage rather than in the business of reportage. And so paying for a newspaper subscription. If you're a person who has a concern about our democracy or who has a concern about freedom of the press right now, the very first step that you should be engaged in is checking yourself and saying, what sources of news am I paying for, right? What am I supporting with my dollars so that I can make sure that editorial discretion and gatekeeping and fact-checking is happening on my behalf? You have to pay for that. You're welcome.
$7.99 a month.
Just okay. Putting that up. Question right here.
Hello. One of you said earlier, I forget your name, I'm sorry, that it's important to consider how an article looks like on social media. So I have a similar question. How has the news evolved as it's become more integrated with social media within the past 2 years?
Do you want to start with that, Jennifer?
So at the Tribune, again, we're trying to catch you at a moment when you're receptive, and on social media it's not very long, so we work a lot on headlines. Can we deliver on the message that we're putting out in one sentence on our Facebook feed or on Twitter? It has to be catchy, but is it also truthful? Because we don't want to be clickbait. We don't want you to click on it just because it was the greatest headline ever. More visuals. Social media requires something to look at, so that's one thing. We used to produce a lot of stories that did not have visual elements to them, that did not, that were super hard to explain. How can you do your elevator pitch? Really, that's the way I look at it now, is we've got 10 seconds to grab your attention. If that, what can we do on a social media feed that will attract you and have you go deeper than just the headline?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. You might have a single story with 4 or 5 really salient points or facts. So for social media, we would focus on one and say, you know, here's this thing that happened. We give it to you in 30 seconds and then try and entice you back to the story. Video is very important. You get on your Facebook feeds all the time that you don't even have to click on sound, right? You'll see an image and then you'll see a sentence and then another sentence and another sentence. That's just quick storytelling, you know, in either a 15-second hit or a 30-second hit. You know, we'll do those too, or we'll do video from found video. Like, if you want to understand what's happening in California with the fires, what's the best way to do it? Well, if you want to go and do an in-depth New Yorker-type read on, you know, why is California burning, you have that opportunity. But the overwhelming majority just want to know what's happening quickly. So in your social media feed, you'll see these images of the fire, the number of homes lost, the number of people dead, comments from some people. President Trump said some provocative comments. And you'll get that, and that might stimulate you to then go for the New Yorker piece. So both of those, the social media is having an impact that way.
In terms of the social media driving people to stories, I know that you have the technology to say people are coming from this area, they're spending this much time on a story, right? I mean, is there anything interesting in that data right there? Are people spending time reading all these stories? How quick do we jump out?
Pretty fast, yeah. Pretty fast. So again, you've got to have some snappy visual. You've got to have a snappy, catchy headline to even get there. And by the time you've read the headline, probably 20% have already gone away. They just read the headline. And wow. You can see people tick, 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 tick. By the end of a story, it depends on the length. I mean, you could only have 30% of your audience still with you. So
does that seem like a fair number, about right? About 30% of the people will get to the end of a story?
Yep. Depends on the size
depends
of the article.
Yeah.
But engagement time is a key metric, right? I mean, you can get page views, but if you have a page view and the engagement time is 20 seconds, you know you haven't done it. But if you have a story and it's of a reasonable length and they're on there for 4.5 minutes, you know, the horrible story about the University of Utah student who was shot and killed, the engagement time on that, where people were reading top to bottom, they wanted to know anything. And I imagine it was the same at the Trib as it was for the Deseret News. People want to know stories that are interesting to you and important to you. You'll read to the end.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah, one thing that I, if I think about the loss of the sort of old school media, legacy media, your sort of standard newspaper drops on everybody's porch and everybody pulls it in and reads the same newspaper in a community, the loss of that model loses a lot of things, as some things that have been described by people here in the audience. But one of the things that I think we lose from that, that I really mourn in terms of our stability as a democracy, is that the newspaper used to be this aggregator of a lot of information, right? So you'd go to it for the movie listings, and you'd go to it for the sports, and you'd go to it for the county council, and maybe you just went to it for the movie listings or the sports, and then you stumbled upon the county council, and in the course of coming to this one entity, you became an educated person in our democracy. You became a person who, through the editorial function and the discretion of newspaper editors, you became the kind of person who accidentally became informed about your Congress or about your local government or about issues of policy that were that mattered to your community. And we're still sort of moving our way toward a place where we figure out what the replacement entities are for that.
Did you submit you watch county council meetings?
Okay. I still do. Okay, that's be the single last person on the planet who is there on the public access television.
Oh, love it, yeah. Love it. Okay, we've got time for one last question right here.
So to kind of follow up with the discussion that's been had in the past 10 minutes, I'd like to know, based on the shift that you've made to social media reporting and getting people to pay attention to things that are important to them, are there issues in either local or national news that you feel like are not getting the attention that they deserve? What are those issues, and what things would you like to see America pay more attention to?
There are so many issues. On the local level, I think that people do not pay enough attention to what's happening unless there's a tax hike. That seems to get everybody's attention. But the mundane business of governing, it's not particularly sexy all the time. And on the flip side, it has great importance for your life and your life and your life. And we've got potholes in the road. You know what I mean? I don't think that people are paying enough attention to the detail of government at the local level. And as our newsroom has shrunk, we've had to make some hard choices. So I don't have a reporter in Harriman every week. I don't have a reporter going to the Davis County Commission every week. It's only when stories get to scale and have broader implications that I can afford to send somebody there. And I think that has consequences for our democracy as well. So many stories that we can't get to, so few reporters. It's a conundrum.
Yeah, you're looking for commonalities. You know, the Deseret News isn't sending a reporter to Harriman every week either to monitor the city council. So what is that left with? That means you either have to have a weekly or something in Harriman, or a city newsletter. If it's a city newsletter, then they're crafting the message.
Can you trust it?
That's the thing. That crafts the message the way they want to. So the watchdog aspects of journalism has taken a hit. I mean, there are half as many journalists across the country now as there were, you know, 20 years ago, even 15 years ago. They talk about news deserts. Is that a term you've heard about, where there's no local media and nothing's happening? And that's a risk. But on the other hand, it does make you hone in and try and do a better job as a journalist. So, example, if there is an issue in Sandy, it's incumbent upon the reporter to say, well, is this thing happening in Draper? Is it happening in Harriman? What about Davis County? Is there a commonality here? Growth remains a key issue. So instead of having a city council reporter, you'll deal with an issue of growth, which you know is hitting every city council. So you do have to do a better job being a reporter.
Yeah, I think there is at least some possibility that citizen journalism can fill in some of these gaps, right? That good people on the ground using social media can alert the people who are looking at the broad issues, right? When people start to talk internally with each other about this is happening in Harriman, and all the people in Harriman are tweeting or are otherwise getting worked up and talking to each other through other mechanisms that now exist, right? That's the upside of living in a world of social media. It's the reason why the Arab Spring basically happened through people's cell phones, is that boots on the ground reporting of basic facts can happen as we all talk to each other. And then professional journalists can sort of step into the fray and help do a lot of the sort of digesting and compiling and helping us capture bigger stories. We just need there to be sort of the system in place and the cooperation to bring that about.
That's Renell Anderson Jones, law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund, and I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.